Ladies and gentlemen, I consider it a real privilege to introduce our speaker tonight, for Frank L. Howley is one of those colorful personalities with exciting and significant experience whom we've all wanted very much to hear and to know. Although best known to us as General Howley, he is much more than just a military man. In New York University, he was a star football player, and at the same time, so I understand, a star scholar. He studied art in Paris. He went into the advertising game and established his own advertising agency in Philadelphia. He left that business to become an active Army officer in 1940. Got involved particularly in the civil affairs branch of the Army, and landed in France on D-Day plus four as a colonel commanding the largest combined British-American civil affairs team. In due course, he became deputy director and director of the United States military government in Berlin, which in simpler terms means that he was for about 4 years military governor of the American zone in Berlin. And that, particularly at the time of the Soviet blockade and the astonishingly successful Allied airlift which broke that blockade. General Howley has therefore had the experience of having to deal as the responsible officer on the spot with the Russians, as well as with the British and the French, in the day-by-day operations of the Berlin occupation. And this was, I'm sure, some experience. I believe he had the reputation of being tough, but he must also have had a sense of accommodation, for I understand that he negotiated some 1,300 working agreements for the Russians and made a large number of them stick. General Howley has written the story of those days in a book which was published, I believe, last January, Berlin Command, which is a vigorous, interesting, and enlightening account, and which gives some clue to what he may mean by his provocative title for his address this evening, Fear for Breakfast. The excellence of his performance as military governor of Berlin is attested by his promotion to brigadier general and by the fact that he wears, or is entitled to wear, the French Legion of Honor and the Croix de Guerre. I'm very glad to present Brigadier General Frank L. Howley.
Chairman, honored guests, ladies and gentlemen. In talking to you, I'm going to make some very positive statements because I'm going to talk about those things which I know. I'm not going to give you a study. I assume that you all make studies. There are some very good books which are written as studies. I'm going to tell you only about my own experiences with Russia and the Communist Party as I've seen it abroad. I'm not going to talk about the internal communism in the United States or the difference between liberals and extremists, a lot of those things. You're probably taught better in school anyhow than I could tell you. The only reason I have nerve enough to tell all of you, including professors, what I know is that they are my experiences, and I have had probably more personal experiences with Russian communism than certainly any senior American. Some newspaper men figured I'd had over 2,000 hours of conference with the British, French, and Russians in Berlin. That doesn't include pig hunts and social events and many bilateral or two-way agreements and talks. Even during the blockade, I ordered non-fraternization with the Russians. They weren't going to eat the food that our fellows were dying to fly in, but I continued our diplomatic relations on the usual direct, blunt basis. Personally, I'm not any of those things which I wish I were. I wish that I were very biased. I wish, you know, that I was a red hot on something. I don't really hate the Russians. I'm not certainly a militarist. I don't believe we have any militarists in the United States. I've talked with some of our best combat generals, and their attitude usually is, well, gee, I hope to God we don't have to do that again. I hope we don't have to fight again. If I were a typical militarist, then what I say would probably not have as much weight, because what I say is a little bit depressing. I'm going to say some strong things against the Russians, yet you must know, and I'll immediately say, that as far as I'm concerned, there's no difference between communism and what the Russians want. I said that 4.5 years ago when it wasn't popular. It's the same thing. Some of my so-called liberal friends, in fact, a couple of fellows who fought with the loyalists in Spain, maintain that this thing which is threatening the world is not communism, but is something special. They call it Stalinism. Well, whatever it is, it's bad. And it is threatening us, and it's very likely to cause a lot more death, a lot more harm to us. The official view now, I believe, is the State Department view in America, that this is traditional Russian imperialism using the Communist Party all over the world. The subject is fair for breakfast. A big part of the thing which is confronting us is a deliberate use of fear. Everybody's afraid. Make no mistake about it. And if you're not afraid, you can be made afraid very easily. There's no businessman who sometimes doesn't wake up at 3 a.m. and scared of a new business adventure. There's no woman who's going to have a child somewhere doesn't wake up and she's frightened. Fear is very deeply dug into us. It's one of the basic instincts. And these people, we consider it not cricket to use fear. They use it as a steady thing, international. A threat is another way to use it. They have great strength. They're threatening Europe now. Europe is a continent of fear now as it has been since the Nazi occupation. They're afraid. And because of that, they, as we, make great concessions to these people who threaten us. We never know when their threat will be developed. We don't know right now, really, whether China is going to make war on us or not. We don't know whether Russia, we know that they won't do it until it's part of the Russian plan. The military man doesn't know now. This looks like the real thing. Whether we'll have to go out there and get what divisions we have involved, fighting people who very recently were quite friendly to us. And then, while they're tied up, these fellows will run across Europe, where they've got 11 armored divisions, 47 infantry divisions that can move in 48 hours, and about 56 infantry divisions that can move across Europe in less than 60 days. And there's nothing there to stop them. We have a division and a half, and the half division of constabulary is equal to a full division because they've got a lot of guns and firepower, but still only one man, you can give them 8 guns and still one man, and they shoot one at a time. British have a couple divisions, so forth. You end up maybe 8 divisions that can fight. Well, no matter how good you are, you get run over. And the Russian divisions, they're good. Now, they're threatening all the time. They threaten. That's the reason you find so much talk of neutrality in Europe now. They don't want to start something and get sort of wiped all over the town. That's the reason we have to send over some divisions to bolster up the feeling of confidence there. They're afraid. Well, what are they afraid of? Well, they're afraid of the Red Army. And they have very good reason for fearing the Red Army. Recently, you've read what that Red Army, which happens to have slant eyes, but that doesn't matter. The communists are all trained the same. Their face changes, their complexion's different, but they're the same world pattern. That army in Europe, the Red Army, which was made up, the corps I went through was about half to a third to a half Asiatic in appearance. Smelly little men, very much the same as Genghis Khan's armies must have been. Smelly sort of leather and fish and stuff. Lack of that. When we crossed, went through that army, we tried the salutes in Tavarish, and they just looked at us the way cattle look at you over fence. Simply obeying orders, and we're just an army. So that's what Europe's afraid of first. Second, their red officers are afraid. This fear technique gets right into their own people. They're scared too. There's no room for failure. They must succeed. They can lie, cheat, swear, murder. That goes for Vyshinsky too, but he must succeed. That's the only thing that matters. And just in passing, I know some of you fellows are good GIs in the making, maybe. They have power of life and death down to the grade of captain. A captain can order his men killed. So a professor at Penn said to me one time, how can they make these people who are not belligerent fight? I said to him, did you ever have your front teeth kicked out? Well, he said, of course not. He hadn't. Well, I said, I couldn't possibly explain it to you. I've seen many, many Russian officers who are dumb, but I've never seen a weak one. I've never seen one who couldn't kill the men in his unit and would hesitate to do it. When we first got to Berlin, I'd like to mention this. As we were coming over tonight, I think I was reminded of this story. I had an officer I sent down to establish contact, Lieutenant Colonel McGinnis. He's up from Massachusetts. He's back in civil life. He owns a coal yard up in Worcester. I sent him down to contact the local Russian Lieutenant Colonel. And when he came back, he was still shaking. He said, while I was down there, I came in and the Russian Lieutenant Colonel was bawling out one of their enlisted men and waved him out. And he said, as I sat down right beside me in the window, there was a shot and they'd killed him. Well, I said, what'd you do about it? He said, I jumped up and I asked the Colonel what had happened to the man. He said, I ordered him executed. And it developed that down to the grade of captain, they had power of just a drumhead court of execution. I'll tell you more about justice as they see it on other levels. But the officers themselves are afraid. General Kvashnin was head of the railroads. He's one of the last men I dealt with in trying to settle a strike. I remembered him because after these difficult arguments I was having with him, when I was leaving, the political advisor, a fellow named Maximov, who used to be Vyshinsky's secretary, said, General Howley's a great horseman. He rides in shows. And General Kvashnin is kind of big round that way. He said, yes, I know that. I've read all about it. He said, I like horses. He said, I used to ride horses too, but he said, I'm too fat now. All I can do is bet on it. The last I heard that he had committed suicide with his wife and one or two daughters. I forgot which he had two when he just said his parents. The rumor is that he was trying to escape into Sweden and was caught and, of course, executed. So the official Russian version was suicide. I could give you long listings of why they're off. The German officials or the Chinese officials or anybody, the Czech officials who are close to these people, who are part of the gang, they're scared. They can't leave them. The nearest thing that you know to know, which would be at all similar to what these people have, is the system of an organized gang, Murder Incorporated, for example. They aren't brilliant. They're not smart, but they've got a system which they carry out with complete brutality. I was going to elaborate on this, but I'll skip down. The masses are afraid. In this recent election in East Germany, someone said to me the other day, why did 92%, it doesn't matter what percent, go out and vote ja? They're afraid not to, that's the reason. They were counted and checked and double-checked. In every house, every apartment house, every block, there's a block lighter. The same system the Nazis tried, only these fellows are much more efficient. When we arrived in Berlin after the Russians had been there 6 weeks and organized it, I found there are 40,000 of these stooges working in the U.S. sector alone. And they had power in their hand over their little apartments because they had the power of the ration card. The janitor, if he happened to be the leader in that house, he could say what Schultz on the fifth floor had for himself and his children in the way of a ration, depending on how good a boy he was politically. Well, the masses are scared. I could go on. Students, you're students. I must mention students. The old and good University of Berlin happened to be in the Soviet sector. So, of course, it was all propaganda. It wasn't education as we know it. And the German young people wanted education. So, they had teachers like this fellow at Gerhard Eisner. I don't know what he was taught. Teaching. I guess he was teaching on how to be carried off a boat feet first, maybe. He doesn't know anything else, except insults. Well, the students had a mass meeting of 1,000 over there, and you guessed it. The Soviet police came in, broke it up, and arrested 12, and no one's ever seen them since. Three or four of them were girls, all up protest. Finally, the students came over to our sector, came to me, and said, can't we study? We'll study in the rubble pile if we can only approach history and science and everything objectively. We don't want propaganda. We went through that. That's all we got from the Nazis. Now we want to study. And finally, we raised $1.5 million and started the Free University of Berlin in the Western sector. There are 4,000 students there right now. At first, people said, oh, you can't get professors. We found that professors were just as anxious to teach objectively as students were to have that kind of thing. You see, over in the Soviet side of town, the student who has what you have, I hope, a critical sense, you say, why? So you don't believe anything, really. You're challenging everything. That's the way your student should be. Some of us guys, as we get old, we kind of get sick and stop challenging things. But in their system, that student never gets an education. You see, he won't get the facility. The student who challenges things, who gets involved in the political phase, unless he's a fanatic, he won't get education. So it's one of those depressing things. There won't be internal revolutions in the next generation either. But that's part of the big story. I'd like to mention justice. How they handle that. One day I was talking to Colonel Yelizar, who married Lenin's sister, Lenin's wife's sister. That makes him quite an old fellow. There's a big age difference. His wife had a 15-pound baby in Berlin all these years. They do things on a big scale. Yelizar, between these sessions, came over to me quite pleased. He said, you know that fellow you were interested in? We've got him. He said, we found him guilty this afternoon, and we're going to try him tomorrow morning. I said, wait a minute now. It sounds like the old army game to me. I said, the interpreter said to me that you found him guilty today and you're going to try him tomorrow. Is that right? And he said, yes. Well, I said, what are you trying him for then? Well, he said, to fix the sentence. You see, the trial, they're not tried until they have confessed. Now, never mind how they get the confession. But the man is guilty or he is not tried. The trial is simply to announce his sentence and to put on a public spectacle the intimidation idea. So when you read about Vogler or Menzinti or any of those others, and you say, that isn't justice, sure it isn't, as we know it. But this fellow is perfectly honest in his approach to it. That's their idea of justice. Well, what are peace rallies all over the world? Peace rallies are another use of fear, you see, to get concessions. You don't want to take off these nice clothes you've got and go out and live in a hole in the ground. I sure don't want to either. The last time I got a broken back and pelvis, my right eyebrow sewed in. I don't like that sort of thing. It's a rough life. Therefore, nor do our families want it to happen again. There's nothing we can gain from a war. Therefore, peace rallies all over the world when an important negotiation is coming up to remind us of the horrors of war which they will precipitate if we don't give them what they want. Now, it's a very old game. It went back even when they were considered our allies. When they wanted the duplicate printing presses of our money, Allied invasion march, the threat was separate peace with Germany if you don't give us what we want, you see. So it's a definite part, fear, threat, use it regularly. Well, what do they want? I mean, it reminds me of this girl who sings Kiss Me, Kate. I don't know whether it's on the road or not, you know, but Liza Kirk used to sing it. Her boyfriend's always gambling the money away and misbehaving, and she stands on the step and says, oh, why can't you be good? Why can't you behave? That's the way we Americans feel so often about the Russians. What are they getting at? Why can't we approach these people? We've tried appeasement. We tried winning them over. We tried allaying their suspicions. We tried buying them off. So when Senator McMahon says $50 billion, we tried that. We gave them $11 billion worth of goods during the war, called Lend-Lease. We gave them in Berlin concession after concession to win them over. Political concessions in the Baltic, in the Balkans. Let them break their agreements one after another, and still we tried to win them over. We tried to understand them. Recognized communist governments which were simply stooges. Agreed to coexistence, finally, when we couldn't get them to work on a united Germany except on their terms. Then we tried what Vyshinsky is now holding out as bait, coexistence. In other words, good neighbors, well, we can't do anything about it. Let them run ours, we'll run theirs. It wouldn't do. They armed troops in Korea. They said, get out. It's all done now. And then the troops armed by them in the north swept down to take over the whole country, which they hadn't been able to get by other means, use of force. Berlin, they tried to seize Berlin and drive us out, use of force. The airlift you know of, which helped us to win that particular scrap. Why won't they behave? What do they want? What are they after? We want nothing from them. We'd like their friendship, but even that, we're willing to coexist. We'll leave them alone. It won't work here, or it won't work in Shanghai, Africa, United States, or any place. Regardless of what Stalin may say today to mislead us, there can be no short target for them except world control. Now, they don't expect it all tomorrow, but they've got it all planned, and they're working on it. Now, General Khodorkov said to me one day, I said, oh, let's stop arguing about class struggle. Let's settle this trolley car problem. And I said, neither you nor I will live to see the end of class struggle. As a matter of fact, I think there are a lot of good things about class struggle. Well, he said, I don't know about you, General Howley, but I'll live to see the end of it. Absolutely sure, say themselves. And the plans are made. Now, if you know Berlin, you know it all over the world. The pattern changes slightly, but it's basically the same pattern. Now, what is it? What do they want? They want economic and political control of the world. And if you want to read their writings, you can find out. They've documented what they're going to do far more than Hitler did in Mein Kampf. Far more. It's all there. And then you've got all of these cases to back it up. So if we don't know now what they're up to, God help us. We never will. Politically, I'm going to divide what they want in world control into political and economic, because that's the way we think. It's all one to them. I was talking to a Russian general one day, and I said, from what you say, it seems as though food is political. He said, of course. Well, I said, are the police political? Why? He said, naturally. I said, is the control of trolleys political? Why? He said, my dear colonel, of course. I said, how about your Russian army? Is that purely political? He said, we've had enough of the discussion. Or again, talking with Russian general, I think it was Colonel General Gorbatov, I said, look, you got to separate the economic and political on this, and I'll shorten the discussion. He said, how can you separate the economic and political? See? So when I separate it to you and say what it is, it's simply for our thinking. Politically, they want complete control, and this is the way it works any place they are. Control of the government, of course. Get it by election if you can, rig it up, twist it, use food, anything, but control the government. But you don't have to have full control. They had 1/3 in Czechoslovakia. They only had 19% in Berlin. But control of the government. Second, control of the trade unions, because under a democratic system, trade unions can pull a strike and make a government that's not doing what they want fall, you see. So they control those. Remember the CGT strike in Paris, which was intended to make the government fall, which wanted to cooperate with us on the Marshall Plan. Third, control of the police. Because if you control police, they may be soldiers like the Volkspolizei in Germany, but you've got the only people with guns. And therefore, even a minority government of the communists stays in power, and it doesn't matter what you think, you in that area, because they've got the guns and they'll use them. That's the reason after they pulled the coup d'etat in Czechoslovakia, you saw the people lined up at Jan Masaryk's funeral crying that their democracy, which was established really with our assistance and which they loved, was being crushed by a very small minority. But every once a while in that lineup, you saw a very straight-faced soldier, man or woman with a gun, didn't you? Well, cry your eyes out, little Czech. It won't make a bit of difference. The government will remain communist, and you can't change it by ballot or anything else when they have the guns. Fourth, they want control of the judiciary. Because if you control the judiciary, you can dress up murder and make it look legal, and they love the garbs of legality. The latest note from China, the United Nations is illegal. Favorite. Always talking about legality. I always call them a bunch of ambulance chasing lawyers. Because law doesn't even follow logic as ours does. They follow sophistry. They'll play on words, anything to win an advantage, confuse the issue. Now, they're the big four, and then they move on to others. Now, in Berlin, we found they had that, and when they couldn't keep it, that's when they used force to drive us out. On the economic side, it's take. You know the old jokes about what's yours is, what's mine's mine, what's yours will divide. There's a lot of truth in it. Now, I don't know whether it's because the Russians are dumb and need all these goods. For a long time, they used to say they were doing it because of what the Germans took from them. I don't know whether it's because communism doesn't produce goods, and I don't think it does. I think that's a basic weakness in their policy, just as a dictatorship today doesn't produce goods. And when I was in school, we learned that a dictatorship was the most efficient form of government, but it was dangerous because it could go bad. It isn't today, but again, that's another story. Observing these people, economically, they take. That's a reason as soon as the Chinese Communist chief went to Moscow, a trade agreement. As soon as they got control of Czechoslovakia trade agreements, they go hand in hand. They take. Just to give you an illustration, in Berlin, before they let us in, they stripped everything they could move. Berlin West, for example, which is in the British sector. We turned over the rich provinces of Saxony and Thuringia with crops in the field, machinery, warehouses bulging. We didn't take a thing because it was going to be their area. When we got to Berlin, they'd stripped everything. They even stripped the Singer Sewing Machine Company. Am I talking too fast? Then they tried to get control of all of the businesses in the city, even after we were there, what was left. Of course, we balked at that. I sent for a legal decision whether they could buy these properties with phony money in 40 corporations. The lawyers were arguing, so after 2 weeks, I issued an order, no. Then the others followed it, and that's still in effect. But in the Soviet sector, Berlin alone, the 27 biggest corporations are now Soviet AGs. Simply, they say, we own them now. And on their masthead are a couple Russian directors. 364 of the biggest plants are working exclusively for their export. Now, what is this take? That's reparation from current production. You hear it discussed. They went through three phases on this economic take in Germany. First, they stripped everything they could get. And we gave them quite a few things from the West on the basis of making up for what harm the Germans did to them. They shipped it to Russia and couldn't make it run. Now, again, I don't care. I don't care. You can say they couldn't make it run for a lot of reasons. Maybe it was because combat troops ripped it out. I went over and saw flat cars loaded with precision tools, and my engineer said useless after 2 days exposed to weather. Anyhow, they shipped them to their satellites into Russia and couldn't make the machinery run. Next, forced labor. They took one morning at between 2 and 4 out of their sector, Berlin, because they didn't dare come into mine, something like 440 people, technicians, electrical workers, and shipped them to Russia. That was phase two, trying to get the workers to run the machinery in Russia. They still couldn't do it. Third, whatever machinery remains in Germany, leave it there, leave the workers who are still there, and take what they produce. That's reparations from current production. You see. Now, we say no to it. They demanded approximately $10 billion worth of such goods from Germany as one of the prices for a united Germany. We said no because there's no point in our pouring in billions in order to lift the economic level of Germany up to the point where Germany is not an economic cesspool in Europe. No use our pouring it in if it goes out the other side. See? So having been denied it for all Germany, they've taken over $9 billion worth of such goods out of just the part they could get their hands on, which is East Germany, where there are about 18 million people living. That's a reason East Germany is awfully, awfully poor. It's one reason. And the West is going up. Well, I think I find time races along. They use force in Berlin. They use force in Korea. Do they want war? Do they want force? No, not for itself. They don't have the dread of force or of death that we do. They don't have the sensitivity. Now, I don't know whether that's communistic or whether it's Asiatic. Again, I'm much more on the objective psychology than the subjective, meaning what goes on in their heads, why they do it. And we've had enough observation now to judge them by what they have done. Berlin, they used force. The blockade was a means of doing three things for them. They hadn't been able to get the controls, economic and political, so they clamped on a brutal blockade, a strangulation of the Western sectors, which made the black hole of Calcutta look like child's play. We are getting so immune to inhumanity in the world that we put up with it. There have been wars and all kinds of things. We're so accustomed to it now, we really accept it philosophically. A whole Chinese army marches in and butchers Americans in a surprise attack, and we refer it and start writing letters on it. We're getting calloused. Anyhow, they wanted to do three things. One, they wanted to seize Berlin because it's valuable for a lot of reasons, economic and political. That'd make us go out because the people, when they started to starve, would say, gee, we like the Western ideas. We have opposed the communist minority, which had sunk down to 3%, but we have to eat. Our families have to eat. Please go so we can live. Or they'd obey the Russian propaganda and riot, you see, and then the Russians could move in troops because Berlin is 100 miles inside of area occupied by the Russian soldiers. Second, they wanted us to leave Berlin to run out. And if we had, our world leadership would have received a death blow. Because the first time someone threatened us, If we ran out, naturally nobody's going to tie up with us. And third, they wanted to see how effective their propaganda was, whether it was true or not. You know, they get to believe these things themselves. A lot like the American Indians before a battle, going around pounding, you know, and whooping it up, I'm the greatest fellow, I'm going to lift 15 scalps. And after they've gone around and said it enough, they sort of have mass, I don't know, mesmerism or whatever it is, or it's some sort of a twisting. They begin to believe it, you see. And the Indian would go off then, he'd get in a fight, and maybe he'd lose his scalp, or maybe he'd win a couple. But they talk so much about us that they wanted to see if, really, we wouldn't fight. It's that simple with it. Our men won't fight for anything. We could be bought off, you see. And second, whether economically we're on the verge of collapse. And, of course, I'm not going to deal with the blockade because you know the story. I was on the ground. We worked out. First place, we knew it was coming. I'll tell you that. That's the reason we had time for an airlift. As early as in March, I knew what their pattern was. I have to say I, because I went up and reported it and I went to Washington. You see, we'd been watching after the conference of foreign ministers broke up in London, which gave them notice we would no longer go to a conference and simply rubber stamp their desires. So we're all waiting for them to get some kind of orders. And finally, when we sat down to confer that day, I knew they had their orders. They'd changed their political advisor from a persuasive Litvinov type to this Maximov, wise, tough guy, and so forth. The general was reduced to the position of reading prepared statements. So well, there were a lot of signs. Anyhow, I reported it. Immediately, I got our experts, and we had some good ones there on economics and food and welfare and everything. We planned what would happen if they tried to blockade us. I had reported the Russians are going to do three things. They're going to break up the German government they agreed to establish and support. They're going to break up the Berlin military four-power headquarters, which is the basis of our having given them Saxony and Thuringia, and they're going to take steps to get us out. I didn't know what the steps would be, but I advised getting women and children out and bringing in a few more fighters, make it worthwhile. Based on that, I had a secret meeting with the British and French general in my home. If it were known, then the Russians would use that as an excuse, you see, for doing what they wanted to do. We had a secret meeting. I said, here's the assumption, these 3 points. And I said, we better get ready, and here's a study. I want you to know, it's marked top secret, and it's in my safe. The French general, General Gonval, said, I don't think they'd dare do it to the Western powers, but it's well to be prepared, they're capable of it. The British general had one of these guards' mustaches. He said, it's preposterous, they wouldn't dare do it, see. I love to kid the Englishmen especially. They wear their handkerchiefs in here and all that stuff. But make no mistake, there's no fighter in the world tougher than an Englishman. They'll negotiate up, though, and it'll break your heart the last minute. But they'll fight, and they'll fight for about the same things we will. We all chipped in, and we got ready for what we knew was coming. So when it came at the end of June, we had 36 days' supply of food, 6 weeks' supply of power, a coal for pumping the sewers and pumping water. It takes 110 tons of coal a day to pump this water up from 1,300 wells and so forth. That gave us time to think and make plans. So the airlift came in then. Finally, we'd won a great victory. We'd succeeded in going through a winter. We had new airfields built by hand. The first airfield out in Tegel in the French sector, we had 17,000 people working with scoops and shovels by hand because you couldn't fly in heavy machinery. We had plans made. Definitely, the Russians, the whole thing had boomeranged on them. The Atlantic Pact, because of Berlin, came into existence. ERP came into existence. They wanted to get out of it. So when they wanted to get out of it, never mind the face saving, they've got 1,000. They'll figure out a new face for themselves, and that's what they did. You hear so much, you know, we have to make a concession to save their face. Only a very honorable man must save his face. I must tell you a story online, because we call each other liars so much, and you wonder why Vyshinsky will say that mad dog stinking liar. It isn't as bad as we think it is. I'm tempted to go and tell you a couple of stories, but I'll just tell you one. One day I was talking to General Smirnov over our partial post deliveries. He gave these big facts out, which why something shouldn't be done. And I said to him when he finished, General, do you know that what you're saying is true now is exactly the opposite of what you said was true last week? He looked at me blandly and said, well, that was last week. See? There is no eternal truth. So now you're saying this fellow's a liar, he's no good. He may be no good, but because he's a liar, it has nothing to do with it. See? If Vyshinsky were honest or frank, which he couldn't possibly be, he'd say, all right, so I'm a liar. Now, what's the point, you see? Let's get along. After Berlin, 70 British and American dead, $500 million spent. It isn't nice to go to a hospital and see tubercular children spitting into a can without enough blankets, so you can't fly enough in. It's bulky. They can't have the windows open. It isn't pleasant to know there are 42,000 cases of galloping consumption walking the streets for lack of hospital space because you can't fly in supplies. It isn't nice to see one winter 2,300 Germans freeze to death. Are these people cruel? Don't ask me if they're cruel. For political advantage, they will do anything, and don't judge them by our standards. After that, we went to Paris. There was, I want you to think of the parallel today. Today, after the Korean victory, $1.5 billion spent, at least 4,500 dead Americans, more than it took us to invade the coast of France, 26,000 American casualties, not mentioning the destruction of property and the dead South Koreans and the murdered Democratic leaders. After all of that, their representatives, it's now the victory on the field is won as it was won in Berlin. What are we going to do about it? And there's the challenge. We did something before and it didn't work. Before, they smiled. And it suddenly became friendly and drank drinks with us, just as they're doing in New York now. They came back to the conferences again. They threatened and they cajoled and they promised. They suggested if we would concede them reparations from current production from Austria, only $150 million worth, we'd get a peace treaty, you see, with Austria. So we agreed. We still haven't got the peace treaty. All we did was give away our principles. Now after Korea, they're smiling again, and they're talking now as then coexistence. That's Fischinski's latest term, coexistence. In Paris, it was two systems can get along together. See. Another point then and now, at Paris, we agreed to status quo, which is a nice way of saying let bygones be bygones. Forget the $500 million. Forget the suffering. Forget the 70 dead. After all, it's past. Let bygones be bygones. And if you work on that principle with these people, they'll confront you, if you don't mind my swinging French in, fait accompli or accomplished fact, and then they'll smile and say, that's over. You see. Now the bait is China. You see. I don't know that the Chinese are cooperating too well with them on their game. But the implication now is that if we'd recognized China, this wouldn't have happened. Hadn't anything to do with it. After all, Nehru recognized them, didn't he? How much did that have, weight did that have for Tibet? So forth. The same game. Because you must remember, we cannot, we must not, we morally are indecent to try to do business with the present government of Russia. That doesn't mean you grab a gun and go shoot them. You may have to do it anyhow. They don't shoot us first. But it isn't preventive war. You've got to start off with a recognition that these people are gangsters and they have control of a nation. And they'll stop at nothing, and their plan, they hate us. Every decent thing we've done to them has only increased their hate. And when any man deals with us and begins to soften, he's yanked and sent away. So, all right, why didn't we charge him for Berlin? Why don't we charge him for Russia? Or charge Russia for Korea? You know that Russia, as I do, I mean, we probably couldn't prove this on the law court because of the books on testimony are that deep. The only way we could get Al Capone was on a basis of evading income tax. Internationally, we can't prove Russia issued the orders. The chief communist of the North is taken off. Kim Il-sung, we won't get hold of him. Why don't we charge them for the harm? Now, there are three things that have to be done in Korea, obviously. One is to help these poor people. I mean, we're great, generous people. We ought to help them. There's great suffering there. Well, let's just cut it down. Two, we ought to make somebody pay for it. If we don't make Russia pay for these crimes all over the world against us, we'll have World War III. And there won't be any question of it. When they're ready, they'll hit us. I'm very sorry to end on a serious note. The only way we can make our opinions be felt in the world today, the only thing we've found that these people will recognize is force. They'll listen to discussion and negotiation. They won't use force against us only if we can make their use of force obviously follow. Well, we allowed ourselves to get weak the last time. We threw our army away. We put our ships in mothballs. We let our planes rot in the jungle, and we invited them to use force, really, when they couldn't get what they wanted by cheaper means such as propaganda and underground methods. So we must mobilize as fast as possible. We can't go on indefinitely $30 billion. We can't go on having more Koreas and Tibets and someplace in Africa. We can't allow them to organize the criminal elements of the world against us, to mislead honest people against us in a manner that you couldn't do in this city. You'd be sued for libel. Russia has to be made and held accountable, responsible. And we don't dare do it until we're strong. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the reason you're going to have to shell out real money. And that's the reason young people have to give up their educations again, so that these people will be prevented from using force, because they are dialectics, they are not emotional. They will not use force unless it has a very good chance of succeeding. They can't possibly match us in the old type of war. It's more than 19 million tons of steel versus our vast production of over 100 million. We're smarter people, we're greater people, we're tougher people, we've got a better system. But we have to stay awake. We have to see to it that we're so strong they won't dare continue to stir up these wars all over. Thank you very much.